The U.S. has seen an increased rate of suicide among its veterans, and those deaths can change the lives of family and friends forever. The second half of Florida Matters' two-part program on veteran suicide starts now.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sessingham. The Department of Veterans Affairs has expressed concerns about the increased rate of veteran suicide and is pouring resources into combating the problem. Starting tomorrow, the VA is expanding emergency mental health care to former service members with other than honorable discharges, a group of vets that is not always eligible for military benefits. Florida Matters is doing a special two-part program on veteran suicide and the impact it can have on comrades and loved ones. Before we get into today's discussion, I just want to spend a couple minutes talking about some key points from last week's program for any listeners that are joining us for the first time. I've been speaking with Chaplain Linda Pugsley, a Vietnam veteran flight nurse and chaplain at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. She shared her own story about her struggles with alcoholism and anger after she came home from Vietnam. And she talked about counseling other soldiers who've experienced isolation and guilt since returning to civilian life.
And they would say, why do I have this sense within me? I feel so badly. How can I be someone who protects life and I had to kill someone?
I asked the panel how they felt about the idea that suicide can be seen by some as a choice, whereas dying by a heart attack or a gunshot is not a choice. Pugsley argued dying by a suicide isn't really a choice.
It's just something is coming up to engulf them and they literally are just jumping to get away from it.
But another guest, Kelly Kennedy, says veterans struggling with mental illness can choose to move forward and tell their own stories. She's an Army veteran, a journalist, and author of the book, They Fought for Each Other. She wrote it after she was embedded in a hard-hit unit in Iraq 10 years ago. A number of her comrades have since died by suicide, but those remaining have created a Facebook page where they can reach out to one another for support whenever they're going through a tough time.
And this year, rates are way down. I don't think we've had any. And it's just that connection.
I've also been speaking with Carla Stumpf Patton. She's the surviving spouse of Marine Drill Instructor Sergeant Richard Stumpf, who died by suicide in 1994. And I say died by suicide because Carla brought up earlier that the language we use when talking about suicide is important, that saying committed suicide, as people often do, can be associated with committing a crime or committing a sin. Carl is now the director of suicide services with the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, or TAPS. Carla works with family members of veterans who died by suicide to help them overcome their grief and rebuild their lives.
Because this is something that changes a family system permanently.
All right, well, let's keep these conversations going. I've got Carla and Linda here in the studio with me, and Kelly's on the phone with us from Washington, D.C. I want to start by bringing up military culture. Linda, we've talked about the special bond that people in the military have, and I wonder how that factors into suicide or suicide prevention.
There's a camaraderie in the military that is not known in the civilian world. The closest thing is law enforcement and firefighters. To that band and that bond that's there.
Yes, so that's very, very powerful when you lose that.
Absolutely. It's one of the factors.
You've been in combat. You come back. Not only have you seen terrible things that are affecting your mental health, but now you don't have your squadron.
You feel lost is what it is. I couldn't even be around my family. They could not understand it. After a couple of weeks of just kind of walking in circles, my dad said, bless his heart, he was a Marine in World War II. He goes, isn't it time to get a job? You know, I mean, I couldn't even think. I ended up moving from the Boston area back to Texas to the unit that I was deployed with. I mean, I couldn't even, I had to be back where we were together.
Kelly,
it's amazing.
Kelly Kennedy, so the soldiers that you got to know started a Facebook page, but are they physically getting back together? Are they having reunions? Are they trying to stay physically in touch?
Yeah, they are. So I feel like this unit is special in a lot of ways, and probably everyone feels that way about a different unit. But the moms have been amazing. Renee Wood, Ryan Wood died 10 years ago, and his mom is putting together a reunion where we're all flying out to Oklahoma City and eating chicken and hanging out at the pool and just laughing. And she calls it a celebration of life and a celebration of Ryan. Ross McGinnis's mom reaches out to the guys and says, hey, you're okay, and Ross would love that you're doing this. The guys are getting together in more of a happy way now, I think. So I think the physical presence is huge. And just being able to, like I said before, be able to be with someone who gets you, who understands your full story. You know, I can list out Ross McGinnis, or I can list out the five guys who died, but unless you know them, unless you know their actual story, it's hard to feel like more than just a name or a number. So it's hugely important to be able to connect physically like that.
I really would like to commend Carla, because there's so much effort that's going forth to prevent suicide. There's so much about the battle buddies. There's so much that the VA, and I mean, I have a list of organizations, the Vietnam Vets and American Legion. I mean, all these things are really coming to bear, and she could really be sitting around feeling, oh, how come, and why didn't have that for my husband and all that, and she's not. She is actively involved to help people get through their suffering to make sure that they are stable. And I think it's a wonderful that she is not having a response that some have done. They buried themselves and just never come. They just never recuperate.
And
from
I don't know how many organizations do what yours does, Carla, mm-hmm. which is what you called postvention, not prevention of suicide, but after it happens. Mitigating the effects on the people that are survivors that are left behind.
Well, sure, I can speak on that. You know, our postvention program is just one part of TAPS, particularly within our suicide services. So we have a dedicated staff where we do address prevention efforts, and we collaborate and partner with, you know, the DOD, you know, Suicide Prevention Office, and the VA, and the different casualty departments, because in that work, the postvention work, which really is just a word for the services and the help that are given to survivors after a suicide, that work really is preventative in nature. So when a suicide occurs, the quicker that we can get in there, whether this is with a unit and working with leadership, or if it's within a family, the quicker that we can get in there and talk to people, get them talking about the loss, getting them the services and the help, the support, getting them connected to their peers, is imperative in the healing process, but it also lowers the risk that they themselves could be potentially at risk for suicide.
Do you ever see that, mm-hmm. where
absolutely.
More than one person in a family?
Oh, of course. Unfortunately, and very tragically so, it's not uncommon. But again, the more that we can get help to them, the quicker we can get in there, that drastically reduces the risk. But by nature of suicide, the survivors who are left behind can potentially, I'm not saying that it's inevitable, because again, we want people to know that there is treatment and the treatment works, but they can potentially be at higher risk for suicide themselves.
Is there anything different about the treatment for veterans than there would be for civilians who are depressed and at risk for suicide?
Well, I think what's unique to the military is the military culture itself. And so my husband was a Gulf War veteran. He was a drill instructor, a Marine Corps drill instructor at the time that he died. And I did remarry another Marine who now is since retired. And it's a culture that many people don't understand. And they have gone through things that, you know, suicide in itself is not a military phenomenon. It's a human phenomenon that really can touch all of us. But specific to the military is the unique culture and some of the experiences that they have endured and been through that perhaps the civilian sect cannot understand. And there can be a big gap either in services or them feeling like, you know, I'm not going to go here. They don't get me. They don't understand. So while essentially, you know, the intervention and the treatments could be somewhat similar, it's understanding the population. But also what's imperative in that is for them to connect to peers. So much like survivors who have been impacted by loss, connecting to fellow peers who have endured this is very powerful. But for the veteran or the service member who might be experiencing emotional crisis, for them to connect to a peer is one of the most powerful things that can help them to get them to seek treatment. And so touching on the question about, you know, is this a choice that somebody makes? You know, when you're talking about a person who is in either emotional crisis or the suicidal mind in general, they oftentimes see two options, and that is life or death. Yeah. Life, you know, in that moment at time to them has become unbearably painful. Mm-hmm. They see no other option other than death to end the pain. It's not that they want to die, they want to end the pain. And so in those moments, anybody could potentially help to save a life. You know, you don't have to be in the ER to save their life. It often is going to be that peer or a family member mm-hmm. just to see that there's a problem and say, I can't fix this, but I'm going to be here by your side and I will escort you. I will get you to the help that you need. So ultimately, what we want them to understand that there is another choice, and that is, can we keep you safe for now and seek help? So that they can give them some time to maybe reevaluate how they view those two choices, that maybe even though life is painful right now, there can be help to alleviate that and expand the options so that they don't think that there's only one choice for them and death has to be it.
And this problem of isolation seems like it would be even worse than it was in the Vietnam era, Linda, because there was a draft back then. And everyone knew someone who was in the military. In World War II, the same thing. There was a draft. People had more experience with military life, whereas now it's almost like the military's over there and civilians are over on here, and there's not as much mixing. So there's, I think, a little more isolation in that.
That's a point for a lot of areas. Our legislators in Washington and our leadership of our country haven't been veterans.
So
whereas in the past, mm-hmm. a viewpoint was, you know, from that perspective. But the sense of being together is one of the unique things of the military. I prefer to go to the VA. And if I have something that I need to go to an emergency room for, I prefer to wait where I see a cap that talks about Desert Storm or Iraq or Vietnam or World War II. Precious World War II people are still around. So it is kind of a community. And I think that because of that, that the people in the community can do a tremendous amount of work because we understand the community.
That's it. I mean, you go through things in these combat areas that really only other people who've been through it can understand it. And that's a bond I would imagine they need to nurture and keep going to have other people.
I'd like to add.
Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
As a female veteran, as any kind of group that maybe isn't typically included in the veterans world, you know, transgender, gay, lesbian, female, definitely. If I walk into a bar, no one's going to assume that I'm a veteran. Even if I walk into the VFW, I'll often get sent to the ladies' auxiliary because mm-hmm. I don't look like a veteran. And that can be isolating. We've got a national conversation right now comparing female veterans to a Disney character to determine whether women should be in the military or not. When people like us, we served in combat 30, 40 years ago. It should no longer be an issue. But it's difficult sometimes to feel like you're included, or it feels sometimes like someone's trying to take away from your service, like it's less somehow, and that can be really isolating.
And women actually are dying by suicide at much lower rates than male veterans. But I imagine that when it does happen, there's differences maybe in the family dynamics and the way that affects the people around them. Carla?
Well, statistically, you know, even at TAPS, you know, we do have more males who die by suicide, but that doesn't mean that it's not that females are immune. When we look at our populations who are at most risk right now, female veterans are one of those populations. Also, veterans who are 50 and older, particularly veterans who are not engaged in VA healthcare system. So they may be struggling, but they're not engaged or active in seeking health, care, and also those who are in the middle of a transition. So those veterans who are getting out of the service now are transitioning into civilian life and maybe losing that connection and the camaraderie that they might have had while they were still enlisted.
And listening to what Kelly's saying about the experience of women veterans, it sounds even more isolating, really, if you're not even looked at a lot of times, is what she's saying, as a real veteran. And you're sent over to sit with the ladies' auxiliary. I mean, it could be even sort of more isolating. Linda?
The isolation is a problem. And for the females, you really can feel isolated. I was out to dinner the other evening, and I had on a Vietnam veteran shirt. And I was with a fellow and his wife, and he had on a Vietnam veteran shirt. And they walked right past me and shook his hand and said, "Thank you for your service." And he looked at them. He's a good friend of mine. He was in Vietnam, too. And he goes, "Excuse me? You walked right past another Vietnam veteran. You need to thank her, too." You know, so it is strange. They do. When I came back, I went to join the VFW, and they said, "Oh, gee, you know, you got to be in the auxiliary." I go, "I just was over in a combat zone taking care of the wounded. Hello, veterans of foreign wars." And I said, "No, it had to be auxiliary." Now, they've changed that. You can be. I'm a life member of the VFW now, but it is.
But Kelly said she still
think, yeah,
feels it.
Yeah, yeah. You absolutely. You were a veteran. They do. They walk past you. Now, I don't know if the research shows that, if that helps to increase the isolation, which sometimes can be one of the, you know, precipitation problems in suicide. But it is something that's very real. I even bought a shirt that said, "I am the Vietnam vet, not the veteran's wife."
This is Florida Matters, and we'll continue our special two-part program on veteran suicide in just a moment. Coming up...
I was driving through stoplights, and it took me 3 hours to read the newspaper in the morning, and I was just really sad.
I'm Robin Sessingham. We'll be right back. This is Florida Matters, and we're talking about the increased rates of veteran suicide and its impact on loved ones. With me are Chaplain Linda Pugsley, a Vietnam veteran flight nurse and chaplain at MacDill Air Force Base, Carla Stumpf Patton with the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, or TAPS, and Kelly Kennedy, Army veteran, journalist, and author of the book They Fought for Each Other. Do you ever recommend literature to help people understand what their veteran family member may have gone through in combat? I read recently this book, The Yellow Birds, by Kevin Powers. Have any of you read that? Kelly, did you read it?
I haven't read it. I've read some of his essays, though, and it looks like it's very powerful.
It's very powerful, and it helped me understand more than anything else. And it's a work of fiction, but it helped me understand more than anything else what people went through in these wars and what could lead them to such a devastating decision to take their own life. But when you read some of the stories about it, it gives you a better understanding. And Kelly, you were there, so.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of guys who simply can't talk about it. There's a lot of reasons for that. I know when I came back and tried to talk to my dad about some of the things I saw in Iraq, he wasn't in a place where he could hear it, because in his mind, I was back and I was safe, and that's what he needed me to be. So me telling him about what I'd seen wasn't a possibility for him. And I hear that from the guys a lot, that they run into these kind of blockers, or they simply can't talk about it. So if they're able to give a book to a family member and say, "This is either my experience or similar to my experience," it can help start the conversation in a safe way.
There's a book called Downrange, and I don't recall the author, but I had a number of copies that were given to me as a chaplain working with the Guard. And it was a lot about PTSD, but it went into a lot about some of the things that are precursors in terms of suicide. So it is very helpful. Sometimes, especially our guys, they can't communicate maybe as much verbally, you know, sometimes on some of the more emotional issues in life. And for them to read it sometimes is helpful. It helps express to themselves what's going on inside. So there are a number of things that can be done.
I also wanted to ask you if you had any opinion on this new Netflix show, 13 Reasons Why. It's really causing a lot of controversy. Any opinion?
Well, actually, I've done a training on that within some of our TAPS events when we bring in veterans who are mentors to our grieving children in our Good Grief Camp, because we want them to be aware what some of our grieving teenagers and children might be exposed to. And even the training around that is about safe messaging. It's about the language. It's about opening up a dialogue. If suicide should come up as an issue, how to talk safely about it, knowing what the resources are, knowing, you know, if for preventative purposes, you know, how you can get people to help. So really it's opening up the dialogue and having a safe conversation around the topic of suicide.
Any worry that it's glamorizing suicide?
Well, I don't want to get too much off topic because that could be a whole, you know, subject in itself. But there are some things around that, absolutely, that, you know, in the field of suicidology, you know, that we've talked about. But we really want the message to be that if somebody is suffering with any type of emotional crisis or a psychiatric illness, that there is help and, you know, that can be treated. And that's something that really wasn't done adequately. You know, that's also entertainment. But we're here talking about real life and people who have been impacted personally. And these are the real stories. And we have either living through it or have lived through it.
Kelly, you're a veteran. Has it helped you to write the books that you've, you know, to write about it and to stay in touch with people? Do you think it's helped your mental health? Has it kind of made you understand your experiences better?
Yeah, and conversely, it's made me a better writer, I think. My experiences in the Gulf War and in Somalia were not as traumatizing as what I saw in Afghanistan and Iraq. And writing the book actually was hard. I spent a lot of nights reliving those stories or interviewing someone who would talk for 7 hours straight and just sort of relive it themselves, and then transcribing those interviews. And it was rough. I was driving through stoplights, and it took me 3 hours to read the newspaper in the morning, and I was just really sad. And, you know, as a journalist, we work really hard to be objective. But after the book was written, the guys have been so great about reaching back to me and including me and saying, hey, you were there too. You're a part of this experience. And that has been enormously helpful. I also went in and talked to someone after I got back from Afghanistan. I did a medevac tour there. I wasn't actually feeling any symptoms at that point, but I wanted to make sure. And that helped a lot too. So I mean, they talk about the rates of PTS for journalists as being the same as it is for combat veterans, and that's not something that we talk about very often. So the guys definitely did help.
Do you feel like you had some of that PTSD when you came back?
Well, so PTSD is made up of a very specific set of symptoms, and I didn't have the flashbacks or nightmares or any of those kinds of things. It was more anxiety and depression than it maybe...
So you had effects. You certainly had.
I did.
Some lingering effects from seeing the things that you saw. Mm-hmm. And what have you found the most effective way to deal with it?
Writing behavioral therapy, actually. You know, when I used to ride the metro in every morning through Arlington Cemetery, and I would get so caught up riding through Arlington thinking about the people there, and I learned that you could come up with sort of a mantra or a tick. So instead of getting caught up in their stories, I would tick off their names on my fingers as I went through and then leave it there and wait for a moment where I could think about it in a way that was controlled by me. So there were some behavioral therapy things that helped a lot.
Kelly, that's really interesting. I'm glad you told us some of those stories. Obviously, you're very close to this subject.
I am. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Linda, I think there were some points that you wanted to make about things that can be done.
What family and friends face, what they can do. Probably one of the most important things is for the family member who's involved as a survivor after a suicide of their family member is to stay connected with the family. The isolation, again, is going to start working on the individual. And sometimes you have to pull away for a while, but it's so, so important. To stay connected, because the last thing you need is to be isolated and alone. And oftentimes we don't talk about the kids, the children. Children are feeling this. Their dad or their mom you know, aunt, uncle, whatever, committed suicide. And here, I'm sorry, I used the word, they died by suicide. They didn't commit suicide. They died by suicide. And so they're feeling it, but they're at a different level emotionally. They're at a different level informationally. So I think we really need to make sure that we pay attention to that. And I love the idea of the camps for the kids so that because, again, like anything, it's a unique situation. And here you are with others who've had that unique situation. And there's a real bonding that can occur with that. But there's a lot of intense emotions, and they kind of need to be able to be helped dealing with that. So I love some of the programs that are going on for the kids, but everyone really needs to be reminded. You're having a normal response to an abnormal situation. This isn't just a run-of-the-mill, everyday situation that goes on. Someone has died. Someone has passed. This is very, very serious for them. And just simple reminders like holidays can be really tough, anniversaries, birthdays. Whenever the person who used to be there isn't there, this can really stir a lot. So it's almost like for those that are family and friends of people who have experienced this, that needs to kind of be in the front of your head too, to realize that this can be a very sensitive time and to be able to be there for them. And people... It's like when anything hits you, you think you're not going to make it and you're not going to survive. Carla is absolute proof that you not only survive, but you survive well, and you take who you are and what you've been through and you bring it to the community to help others. It just absolutely, I mean, she is a walking example of what can happen when you go through this process properly. It doesn't mean she doesn't grieve. It doesn't mean this didn't exist. But to have other family members and friends see her and say, okay, I'm hurting now. I'm down for the count now. But I can get up. And it might even stir them to take their unique experiences and bring it out to others, which is absolutely amazing.
That's Chaplain Linda Pugsley at MacDill Air Force Base. We've also been talking to Carla Stumpf-Patton, Director of Suicide Services with the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, and Kelly Kennedy, author of the book, They Fought for Each Other. Thank you all so much for being here in this special two-part program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for doing this program. I appreciate it.
There are a lot of resources that can help with veteran suicide prevention and healing, and we've linked to some of those organizations on our website, WUSFnews.org. Just click on the Florida Matters tab. We'd also love to hear from you. Whether you've been touched by veteran suicide or just want more information, share your questions and comments with us on our Facebook page or email us at floridamatters@wusf.org. Florida Matters is produced by Stephanie Colombini. Our engineer is Craig George. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sessingham. Thanks for listening.